Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
There's still time to save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Create stunning patios and strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, get free estimates fast with our easy-to-use design and buy program in-store or on Menards.com. Don't miss out. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. Joining us back on the program is Imogen Edwards-Jones, a journalist and writer of 20 novels, including the best-selling Babylon series. After studying Russian at Bristol, she travelled extensively within the old Soviet Union, studying further in Kiev. Based on real events, her latest novel, The Witches of St. Petersburg, is set when the Russian Empire is on the verge of collapse, and two sisters introduce Rasputin into the Russian court. Also joining us is David Nolan, a multi-award-winning author, television producer and crime reporter. He's written a dozen books, including Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil, the true story of the largest historic abuse case ever mounted by Greater Manchester Police. He presented a BBC Radio 4 documentary based on the book called The Abuse Trial. His debut novel, Black Moss, is set in April 1990, when rioters take over Strangeways Prison. And finally on tonight's book show is Linda Haddock, who worked as an English teacher, a head teacher and a local authority officer, responsible for educating pupils who were experiencing difficulties with their lives. Her young adult debut novel, Ellen Lives On, offers support and escape for those coping with parental suicide. The book is set in 1971, in the early years of feminism, which we see through a young girl's eyes. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning. The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you. Live your life with arms wide open. Today is where your book begins.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK, back on the book show, is Imogen Edwards-Jones. She's a journalist and writer of 20 novels, including the best-selling Babylon series. After studying Russian at Bristol, she travelled extensively within the old Soviet Union, studying further in Kiev, and her first book, The Taming of Eagles, was about the first 100 days of the collapse of communism. She's back with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel based on real events. It's called The Witches of St. Petersburg. Welcome to the book show, Imogen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Very lovely to be back.
It's great to have you back with us. And this is a very, I know you started with a book about Russian history, but having done the Babylon series for many years, this must be a very different thing for you, is it?
Do you know what? Yes. Well, it's historical fiction. So it's a very, very big departure from what I'm normally known for. But I did edit Julian Fellowes' Belgravia last year. So I kind of learnt a bit from the master, as you can imagine.
Yes.
So I sort of saw exactly how the process works. And it's quite interesting how you have to hold yourself back from sort of covering it with detail. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
What the reader doesn't want to hear is how much you know. The reader wants to hear, a really good story.
Mm.
So it's a very interesting process and a very different process from one I'm actually used to.
So having studied Russian and travelled throughout the old Soviet Union and everything, is this more you, would you say?
Well, it's been 8 years' work, so it's my real labour of love. I have been, I first heard about the story of... They are called the Black Princesses in Russia. So they were. I first heard the story about them in 1992. So it's been that long in the process, as you can imagine. It's been percolating for years, and it's the book that I've always gone back to while I've had a break between one of the other ones that I've been writing.
Mm. So is it something that you're really passionate about, Russian history?
Yes. Absolutely, yes, and Russia. I spent a lot of time in St. Petersburg researching the book. I stayed with a friend of mine called Katya Golitsyn, and she runs this the Prince George Golitsyn Memorial Library in St. Petersburg, which is where I spent months and months and months photocopying nearly every single book that they've got there in order to read up on the princesses.
Fabulous. And you've also become a member of the London College of Psychic Studies.
Yes, I have. Well, the book is about black magic in the Russian court and about the occult and about spells and witchcraft. And I thought, if I'm going to write about it, then I should actually understand a bit more about how the process of how all these things work. So I did a scrying course, which is crystal ball reading, which was genius. And then I did mediumship, which is really talking to dead people. And then I found palmistry, which is one of my big loves now. So I've been doing palmistry for about 3 years, 4 years, which is amazing.
Oh, fantastic. So how did you find it? Did you go in a little bit sceptical then to the psychic school?
Well, how I went in was, there's a friend of mine called Jessica Adams, so I don't know if you remember, she's also a writer, but she's also an astrologer, and she was a member of the London College of Psychics. And so she said to me, I was trying to find some very, very special, interesting books about magic and ritual and witchcraft, and you can't really find those in any normal average library. So she said to me, go to the London College and stand in the library, and any book that you will need will make itself known. What? just stand there and they will make themselves known. So I said, what, will they fly off the shelves? She went, no, that's Hogwarts. That's Hogwarts image, and that doesn't happen. But what they will do is you'll suddenly become attracted to some book. So I did. I went into the London College, which is over 150 years old, the college, and it's an extraordinary place. And it was founded as the Spiritualist Society, and it was... what really sort of took off in about the 1920s, just after the end of the First World War, when everyone wanted to contact their dead father or brother or son or lover. And it was really went crazy under Arthur Conan Doyle, obviously, of Sherlock fame, who was he did run the college for about 5 years. Anyway, so a lot of his books are in the library. What I was trying to say. A lot of the Arthur Conan Doyle's books were in the library.
Mm.
And so that's where I was wanting to go. Anyway, so I did stood in the library, and a couple of books did make themselves known, sort of slightly, just suddenly they looked a bit more obvious than all the others. There was one brilliant one on witchcraft, which I got, and a couple of other ones about the devil. And then I just decided it was the best place to be. So I went back in, and I've had just the most incredible time studying there for the last 5 years.
And what have you learnt?
I've learnt, well, I can read palms now quite successfully, so I can I can tell if you're a sexual deviant just by looking at your palm. I can also tell if you're good with money, if you're kind. I mean, but that's just by glancing across the table. To do a proper reading, I would obviously have to take hold of your palm. But it's quite interesting in meetings and things now. I just find myself glancing at people's palms, thinking, oh, I wouldn't like to trust you with a £50 note.
Oh, how interesting. Sort of thing.
It's quite fun. But I did have an amazing time doing the mediumship course, where I did have sort of some quite interesting experiences with spirit, as it were. No, it's an amazing place. It's my friend Jessica described it as Hogwarts for grown-ups, and that's exactly what it is. It's properly brilliant.
So when you did the mediumship course then, and you say you had some experiences, were you able to contact the dead, as it were?
Well, there was this one brilliant lesson where we had Jeffrey, who was my teacher, said, let's open the door and see who comes in. So obviously he went over to the door and opened the door, and obviously nobody came in, physically, obviously, but spirits came in. So I had this person opposite me. The idea was the spirit would stand behind whoever they wanted to contact, and the person opposite you would try and intuit spirit behind you. So I'm sitting there, and this girl, who's clearly much better at talking to dead people than I am, suddenly said to me, the woman standing behind you comes with the sound of peacocks. And so I looked at her and I thought, that's really weird, because she's not to know that the sound of peacocks was the sound of my childhood. And not that I was born and brought up in anywhere so glamorous as India, but I was brought up about 25 miles south of Birmingham, and opposite our house there was a farm, and the farmer's wife, her hobby was to breed peacocks. So as a child, I would lie in bed at night and in the evenings, the summer evenings, and hear the sound of peacocks. Anyway, the woman standing behind me was indeed the farmer's wife.
How incredible.
She talked to me, yeah. Amazing. I mean, it really is amazing, and there's something incredibly comforting to know or to believe that there is life after death, and the idea that, you know, it's not a sort of finite journey that we're on. All of us.
Absolutely.
So I rather loved that place, and I loved the college, and I loved their ethos, and I loved their sort of all-embracingness of you know, mad, weird, wonderful people, all of whom are there.
Fantastic. So going back to the book then, the Russian Empire is on the verge of collapse, and that revolution is in the air. What time period are we talking about?
We're talking at the turn of the last century, so under the Tsar Nicholas II, mm-hmm. just at the time of Rasputin. And Rasputin plays a major role in the book. And my girls, the princesses, well, they were called Militsa and Anastasia, and they were princesses from Montenegro, and they married into the Russian court, and they were very, very interested in black magic and the dark arts and table tipping and Ouija boards and all that, and they were the ones who brought Rasputin into the Russian court. So it's all basically their fault.
So how much of it is true and how much of it is made up?
I would say it's hard to say, because these girls, because they were women and because they were the wrong side of history, they are very, very, very little is known about them. So despite the years of research, you literally are picking up tiny pearls out of rather large oysters. So I would say about 80% of it is true. The last 20% is me having fun.
Yeah, fantastic. And I bet it was fun, was it?
Oh, it was really good fun. I mean, the internet is the best waste of time of your entire life. I mean, I have disappeared down a sort of K-hole of jewellery research and dresses and interiors and food. I mean, that is just the best fun to be had sitting on your own. I mean, it's really wonderful. There was a point where I suddenly decided I've got to stop looking at tiaras. I just must rein in the tiara thing.
It must be
because
difficult.
They've got so much jewellery.
Yes, it must be difficult to tear yourself away from the research and write stuff down.
I know, and there is a moment where you think you've got to stop now and actually do some work, rather than sitting there looking at Fabergé, just going, oh, I might just, you know, looking at those beautiful eggs that sort of spring open and do things. I mean, really incredible stuff. Yes, it is. It's very, very difficult, and you have to be quite disciplined, and you actually have to sit down and say, okay, enough is enough.
Yeah.
And then also someone asks you a question when you're editing, and you think, oh, and then you go back down the same journey all over again, thinking, you know, I'm just going to research what they did with Rasputin's toenails.
Oh, nice.
Which
Why
they
not?
Did actually quite a lot with Rasputin's
really?
Toenails.
What did they do with his toenails?
They would sew them into their dresses. They would cut his toenails off and sew them into their dresses because they thought that he was so magical that they would save them and you know, give them magical powers.
Oh, my gosh, how weird.
And that they could climb out of a grave using his toenails.
Gosh.
Like sort of the idea that if you died with his toenails that you would be able to climb out of your grave and be resurrected. They were very superstitious during that period, obviously.
And presumably there weren't many people like them in that. Did everybody think they were weird?
The witches of St. Petersburg?
Mm.
Yes, they did. But at the same time, there was that the interest in the occult was growing dramatically during that period. And there were these things called the Black Salons, which were in St. Petersburg at the time, where people would go and read tarot cards, or they would sit and do table tipping or Ouija boards and try and contact the dead. It became increasingly fashionable during that period. I mean, so much so that the Tsar, Alexander II, used to contact his dead father to try and get advice on foreign policy. I mean, yes.
Amazing.
So, I know, extraordinary.
So writing this book, has it inspired you to do more historical fiction, do you think?
Yes. I was literally just thinking this morning, I was listening to a very, very interesting documentary on Radio 4 about Marie Antoinette. And I was thinking, ooh, she sounds good. I think I might have a look at her. Mm. It's just sort of, you're just thinking, I mean, what I really want to do is try and find interesting women in history that have people have sort of slightly got the wrong opinion of.
Yes.
And give them another chance. Do you know what I mean? There are lots of people. I mean, for example, the Tsarina, Alexandra, was very, very, very much hated, obviously, at the turn of the last century. And then if you look into it a bit, you can see how incredibly difficult her life was. And how incredibly sad and lonely she must have been. And so I've sort of tried to rewrite her a bit in the book as well, try and give her a bit of a voice.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these people get written off and it becomes a sort of trope, you know, an idea that, you know, oh, she was always awful. When in fact she wasn't really. She was just very unhappy.
Yeah. And will there be more in the Babylon series, do you think?
I'm not at the moment. I have been thinking about it. I have was thinking a bit about maybe the art world, that's always quite interesting, particularly after that fantastic Banksy stunt the other day. I think the art world is ripe for somebody having a little look at it more closely. But at the moment, there is not a concrete plan at the moment to do another one, though.
Well, I'm always here if you want to do radio.
Oh, thank you.
I'll come up with
thank
as many
you.
Juicy stories as possible. If not,
yes,
I can
I
make
bet
some
there
up.
Are.
Brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Witches of St. Petersburg, it's out now and available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Imogen Edwards-Jones, who we've been chatting to. Imogen, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Online at tre.radio.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is David Nolan. He's a multi-award winning author, television producer and crime reporter. He's written a dozen books, including Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil, the true story of the largest historic abuse case ever mounted by Greater Manchester Police. He presented a BBC Radio 4 documentary based on the book called The Abuse Trial. Officers involved in the case helped David with the police procedures featured in his debut novel, Black Moss, which we're talking about today. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for joining us. So how was the transition for you going from non-fiction to fiction?
Oh, it was horrible. I've got friends who write fiction, and I always used to make fun of them, saying, oh, it's easy for you guys, you know, I have to do all the hard work, I have to do all the research and the interviewing people and all this kind of stuff, and you guys just make it up, it's easy. And then when I did, you know, go over to the other side, I realized, oh, you know, I've been really unfair to them all this time. It is very, very hard, it is not easy at all. So I take my hats off to all those people that I made fun of before.
Oh, so why did you find? I can understand why you thought it must have been easier than writing non-fiction, but why did you find it difficult then?
A variety of things, really. I mean, I've written for a living all my life, all my working life, and that's now 37 years. And I've never written anything, you know, for myself before. I've always written for other people because I've been told to write, or I've been asked to write, or, you know, it was the first time I've ever had to do anything and be motivated by myself.
Yes.
Which is hard in the first place. And then I kind of made it difficult for myself, because kind of truth and accuracy is in my bones. I can't help it. So that I was in the position whereby if I said, you know, a character got out of his car and went up this hill, God bless me, I went out and I drove there and I ran up the hill to see how long it would take.
Amazing.
Because the idea of then someone coming up to me and saying, oh, that's not right, it would take much longer to do that, or that's not realistic, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
That would drive me crazy. So, you know, if you're going to get the police procedure correct, and you're going to get the journalistic procedure correct, because there's a lot of journalists in this book, and it drives me crazy when crime fiction books don't show journalism accurately and correctly. So you've got to get the whole thing correct as well. So God bless me, I walked the locations and I went through. I took my daughter with me, and she was like, Dad, what are you doing? You're mad. Why don't you just stay at home in the warm? You know, why are we out here, you know, on the moors in Oldham, you know, at silly o'clock in the morning? But that's just the way I did it.
So you still did a massive amount of research that you would have done for a non-fiction book.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there were some aspects of it. It's partly set in the present and partly set in 1990 during the Strange Ways riot, which happened in April of 1990. And I was at the riot, not as a rioter, but as a journalist, you know, standing outside, sleeping outside the jail for 25 days. So that aspect of it, I was okay with that. I knew about that, not a problem. As you mentioned before, I did a book about a historic abuse trial previously, which, you know, I remember speaking to you guys about very kindly. You got behind that book, which was great. And so that aspect of it as well, I was quite au fait with. But I needed help with some of the procedural stuff about how missing children are dealt with now and how they were dealt with back in 1990. And also, and you're like this, you know, as being a radio kind of, you know, anorak, as we used to call them. I knew about the old radio stuff because I'd used to work in radio, but I didn't know about so much about the modern radio stuff. So I had people helping me out with the kind of the technical aspects of that as well. So, yeah, always some research, but the kind of line between the reality and of some of the things that happened to me back in the old days and stuff that I made up is fairly blurry, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but I was going to say, because even though the story and the general idea of it all is fiction, there are elements to it that did actually happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, the Strange Ways riot was... It's sometimes hard to get across to people, you know, because it was 1990 and it's obviously pre-internet. What a huge, huge thing the Strange Ways riot was. It's just stopped. Everything stopped for the riot, which is kind of where the idea came from, really. Somebody told me that during 9/11, the attack on the Twin Towers, there was one murderer in New York. Someone took the time and trouble to use that as a distraction to do a terrible thing, and that murder's never been solved.
Wow.
So I thought, well, what is this, what could I think of during my time that was so huge, not on the same scale as that, obviously, but it was huge on a kind of, on a city level, on a Manchester level, which is where I live, that someone could use as a distraction. And I remember I covered the riot for 25 days and I didn't do a single other story for the whole other 25 days. That got me thinking, well, what else was going on during that time? When we were all looking, the police and the journalists, and we were all trying to make a name for ourselves, we were all trying to use it as a leg up, be it, you know, police officers or journalists. What else was going on that someone, so that's where the idea came from, that someone could use a huge kind of news story as a cover for doing something really, really terrible.
Absolutely. It's an interesting one, isn't it? I remember reading and feeling sick, thinking how absolutely horrendous it was when the tsunami happened and all those people lost their homes and their businesses and their lives, of course. People were going around stealing wallets, and people who'd lost, you know, so many possessions already. There were people out there that were trying to take what little people had left. And you just think, God, what goes on in people's heads to do that?
It's weird, isn't it? It brings out the best in people. Terrible things bring out the best in people, but I think they also bring out the worst in people as well.
Mm.
And that is, I mean, that's what kind of crime fiction is all about, really, isn't it? It's the worst of people. That's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people love it so much, because it represents the worst of us. That we would kind of think, oh, well, I would never do that. I would never, you know, that's not me. And I think that's maybe why people love crime fiction so much, because they like to visit that.
So tell us about the characters in the book and a bit about what happens without giving anything away, obviously.
That's tricky, that, to be honest.
Yes.
Basically, the riot is going on. It's April 1990. Manchester has come to a standstill because of the Strange Ways riot. And all the good journalists and all the good police officers are dealing with the riot. And a not very good journalist and a not very good police officer are dispatched to investigate the finding of a child's body out on the moors near Oldham on the outskirts of Manchester. And 26 years later, the people involved all come back together again to try and work out what really happened, not being happy with the findings they got, and that unleashes a whole load of unpleasantness, a massive load of unpleasantness. It's a proper nasty book, not in a kind of gratuitous way, but it is, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted.
And for people who don't remember that the Strange Ways riots or weren't aware exactly of what was going on at the time, as you said, it was before internet and everything, can you just explain a bit more about it, what happened?
The April 1st, 1990, a group of prisoners who were unhappy with conditions in the jail. They were still slopping out at that time. There was allegations of brutality and problems with food and hygiene. And during a chapel service on April the 1st, which was a Sunday, they overpowered the guards, took over the jail, smashed their way into the roof, and basically occupied the top end of the jail and the rooftop for 3.5 weeks. And those images, anyone of a certain age will remember those images of the rioters on the rooftops holding up banners and signs and basically, you know, thumbing the nose to the authorities and the Home Office and the government and the police, and which they did for 25 days, an extraordinary time. And it actually changed the prison system in this country. You know, the system of keeping prisoners in British jails changed as a result of the riot.
Wow, fantastic. So how did the authorities get the prison back then?
Well, there was all this talk, and that's why we were all while we were all outside at the time, you know, the real journalists, not the fictional journalists, but we were outside, you know, wait, because we were told the SAS are going in today, the SAS are going in tomorrow, the SAS are going in on Saturday, and of course it never happened. It just became this bizarre, surreal standoff between the government and the rioters. Now, and I'll give you an example of how surreal it was. They were on the roof and they had, you know, they were trying to shout messages to their family and to the journalists, you know, using, you know, orange traffic cones as megaphones to shout down. And every time they tried to do it, the Home Office would drown them out by playing Mr. Blue Sky by ELO through giant speakers.
Wow.
Absolutely surreal. And this went on and on. And also this carnival kind of thing built up around the jail. So you could buy, you know, you could buy beer at 2 o'clock in the morning or, you know, Strange Ways breakout T-shirts. And, you know, it became this carnival in the centre of Manchester that went on for nearly a month. It was absolutely surreal. And, you know, to be there, and I was a young guy at the time, I was just turned 25 at the time, and to have all this. But also, you know, it sounds quite funny that, but also I can remember one night, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, hearing the rioters, and they were trying to smash down the wall to get to the E-Wing, where they house the sex offenders. And they were smashing down the walls, and I could hear them smashing down the walls from outside the jail, and they were shouting, "Beasts, beasts, 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 beasts," telling the E-Wing prisoners that they were coming to get them. Incredibly frightening for me standing outside, let alone for people inside.
And were there any deaths?
Yes, there were. There were two deaths. One prison guard as a result of it. There was a huge... the main people were charged with prison mutiny. It was... You know, but ironically, you know, the prison system did change for the better as a result of the riot, which is one of its many kind of the strange things about it, the strange ironies in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you think there will be a follow up to this book? It sounds like there could be more legs to it.
Yes. The thing is, when I was writing it, I didn't tell anybody I was writing it. I didn't even tell my wife I was writing it.
Wow.
And I've written a lot of books, so I spend a lot of time writing. And I didn't tell anybody because I was slightly embarrassed about it, to be honest with you, because there's something quite noble about, you know, I'm an author and I write factual books. You know, there's something quite, you know, quite noble about it. But being a novelist is very strange for me, you know. So I did it in secret. So yes, I am. But for me, the connection. Actually, one of the main character for the story is the landscape around Manchester, the hills and the moors, and the, you know, we have a lot of talk, don't we, about sort of Scandinavian noir and Norwegian noir and all this kind of stuff. I tell you. The landscape in the hills around Manchester, and Blackmoss is a real place. It's a real reservoir on the outskirts in the hills of Manchester. The landscape we have is as bleak and as foreboding as anything that the Scandinavians have got. Thank you very much. You know, so the connecting theme, I think, with the books will be the landscape, that bleak moorland. There aren't even any trees up there, you know, and yet you can see the centre of Manchester. It's such a bleak place. I think it's fascinating. So yes, but that the connections will be that landscape, that bleak kind of, you know. So yeah, so it's not sort of Scandi noir. It's Manc noir.
I like it, Manc noir. Brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of Black Moss, it's out now by David Noland, who we've been chatting to. They can get it from our website in the TRE bookshop section. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
Talk.
Radio Europe, the book program, presented by Hannah Murray. The book program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Linda Haddock, who began her career as an English teacher and has subsequently worked as a head teacher and a local authority officer with responsibility for educating pupils who were experiencing difficulties in their lives. Linda is the author of several books about young people and education, but her first novel is now out. It's called Ellen Lives On, and it offers support and escape for those coping with parental suicide. Welcome to the book show, Linda.
Thank you. Really good to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. And what an interesting and serious subject you've decided to tackle.
Yes. Yes, I think. Yes, I think there were several reasons. You know, the motivation was various. But I was thinking partly about the young people I used to work with, who experience all kinds of stresses and difficulties in their lives, you know, abuse, abandonment, poverty, homelessness. At one of the centres I worked with, there was a young person who used to turn up at the centre having slept on the streets. And I was aware, as you know, I started out as an English teacher, how important literature could be, telling stories, reading stories about other people who'd experienced dreadful things in their lives but had learned to be resilient and to overcome them. But I think literature has that power.
Yeah, definitely. For young people particularly, I suppose.
Yes, I think so, yes, because they're just finding out about the world and their experience is limited. So, yeah, I think that's true.
So why did you look at parental suicide particularly?
Well, there's some family history there. So there was a suicide in my family. And one of the things that, I mean, it's partly because of that that I kind of identified with those young people, I guess.
Yeah.
But also I was aware that there's an increased and welcome emphasis on, or awareness, public awareness of mental health, particularly amongst young people, and a growing awareness of, I think, an increasing incidence of suicide. Most of that is on the pain and suffering of the people who commit suicide, you know, absolutely understandably. But there's not so much discussed about the impact on the survivors, which can be devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I was at school, I would have been about 8 or 9, and a girl at school, her father had committed suicide. And,
oh, really?
And I just remember feeling, even at a young age, just how absolutely awful that that must be for her. And I remember she was quite a happy child, and then when that happened, she wasn't a happy child, and she just sometimes burst into tears at school or at brownies and things like that. And I just remember feeling, I wasn't close to her, I wasn't really good friends with her, I just knew her from school, and just being an unimaginable thing for a child to have to cope with.
Yes, unimaginable. And I read somewhere that the impact of a suicide can trickle down the generations. You know, it's not just that generation, but it can also have an impact on future generations. So talking about it and giving people support, I think, is terribly important.
So tell us about the characters in your book.
Okay, well, Ellen is, shall I say a bit about what happens in the book?
Yeah.
Talk about Ellen. So Ellen's 15, and she comes home from school in the 1970s to discover that her mother has hanged herself. And Ellen then, you know, her world becomes dramatically dark, unreal, distant, frightening. And after the funeral, she goes to stay with her aunts. And this is the 1970s, so there are very traditional male-female roles in the housework. Ellen is pressed into housework. She's a clever girl, but she's kind of waiting on her cousins. And she retreats into a kind of desperate silence. And one of the things that I've learned from working with young people is that this is a generalization, but there's some truth in it, that boys tend to act out When they're distressed, you know, they'll get angry and throw things and be difficult. My experience of working with girls and setting up girls' groups and getting them to talk about what's happening in their lives is that they tend to internalise it, to go into that kind of silence. But one of the changes for Ellen is when she reads about a campaign to introduce comprehensive education into her area. And she remembers how her mother used to support that. Her mother had a strong sense of social justice. And thinking that her mother would have approved, Ellen, in an act of rebellion, you know, she finds a bit of strength, and she writes to the local paper and says, I think our school, she goes to a posh selective school where she's a scholarship girl, I think our school should become a comprehensive. As a result of which, she's told off roundly by her aunt and uncle, rebuked by the head teacher, rejected by her fellow pupils. So she runs away to find her grandfather, who she loves and who loves her. And as she wanders through London, she gets caught up in several adventures, but one of them is to get caught up in a women's protest outside a burger shop, where the burger shop is aiming to ban women after 10 o'clock because there's risk that they'll be assaulted, and the women are saying, ban the men who assault us, not
yeah,
women.
Absolutely.
So she gets caught up in that, and one of the women, the women are squatting and fixing, they're part of a kind of radical political movement, and they offer her a place at their house if she can't find her grandfather. And she discovers her grandfather's in hospital, so she goes to stay with the young women, and there she discovers some comradeship, radical politics, gets involved in what we now call the second wave women's movement, and starts to rebuild her life. So I think what she does, the character of Ellen, is she gets her strength from, I suppose, three things. One is from her grandfather, and my experience is it's, and the young people I worked with, if you had just one person who cares about you and believes in you, that's hugely strengthening. It helps to build your resilience, makes a real difference. Having a set of sort of values that you live by and getting engaged in the world outside yourself, that makes a difference. And Ellen had learnt that from her mother. So finding a group of young people who are living out those values and campaigning against racism and campaigning for equality, she gets some strength from that. And she also gets some strength from talking at a women's group with other women, sharing her experience and having it acknowledged and understood.
Mm. I think a lot of people know, I mean, it takes people, some people longer to realise than others, but the importance of communication and sharing your problems and your feelings is hugely beneficial to everybody, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes, yes, absolutely. And recognising that you're not the only one.
Mm, exactly.
Yeah,
there is. There's no situation that I can think of that somebody could be really alone and that nobody else will have experienced that.
No, that's right. And I think I've done a lot of work with groups. And one of the things people say quite often when they've talked about something difficult is, I thought it was just me.
Yeah, and it's never just you. And that's why I think, and obviously you were saying in the introduction, books and literature can be a great way of getting people to understand and have that support, because it's done in a fictional way. It's a lot less, I think, the way to say it, intrusive, I suppose.
Yes, it gives you that distance, but you can still engage with the feelings and the emotions and the reactions. And I think it's true as well of children writing. You know, it isn't just them reading, it's also true of them writing. I know a young teacher, this isn't particularly about Ellen, but I think it's relevant. I know a young teacher who was working with a boy, he was about 9, who was obviously unhappy. And none of the teachers or anyone at school could find out what was wrong with him. And the teacher gave the class a writing exercise, which is a frame in my magic box I put to start each each verse with that. So this child wrote, in my magic box I put, you know, my toys, my books, my... And then finally, in my magic box I put my friend who died.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah. So the power of literature and imagination to help people deal with life, really.
Mm, definitely. Definitely. So how did you find the experience of writing this, being your first novel, compared to the other books you've written?
Completely different. Mm. Completely different. So the professional books I've written, I just kind of, you know, sat down at the computer and wrote them. And it was just part of the job. I mean, I enjoyed it. It was just part of the job. But there was kind of something tangible to write about. So I wrote a book, you know, with a colleague called Girls' Voices, which is about a project we were doing with girls' groups. And we had lots of research material, so it was a case of organising the material and systematising it and looking at the theory. And, you know, completely different. With this, I found the idea emerged quite slowly. So it came into my mind at odd times of the day, and then I started to sketch out a plot. And I did have a structure. I know some people say they just start writing and then see what happens. Mm. But I did have a structure. And then I gave myself the very structured job of writing, I think it was 500 words a day, come what may, whether I had an idea or not,
yeah.
Whether I had time or not, sit down, write your 500 words, and see what happens. And things happen. You know, things you're not expecting happen, come out from the ends of your fingers.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
And was it quite therapeutic in a way?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I think it was. Finding a way of expressing feelings and experiences.
Mm.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of Ellen Lives On, it's out now and available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Linda Haddock, who we've been chatting to. Linda, thank you so much for joining us and best of luck with the book.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure to talk to you, Hannah. Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.